Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Peepskate Pandemonium, a production brought to you by GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com, where we take you down memory lane for a look at professional wrestling the way it used to be, with conversations from those who paved the way. And now the GWH Radio Network presents Peepskate Pandemonium.
Good evening, everybody. Welcome to Peepskate Pandemonium. This is the January 26th, 2012 edition of our show, and we're all three back on the air. This is Michael North. I'm joined, as always, by my co-hosts, Jerry Oates and Bobby Simmons. And good to have you back with us, Mr. Oates.
Thank you, sir. Glad to be back.
We had a good show last night. It didn't go as long as we had hoped, as Bob had to rush off to the airport to pick up his kids who were flying in from Las Vegas, but
it was past his bedtime.
He did promise us another show with us where you could join us and tell us about rubber snakes and stuff.
Oh yeah, we've got something to tell, believe me. Jeez.
And for those of you that were listening to the show last week or who downloaded the archive, Bobby and I didn't hang up on you. The system just decided it had enough of us and hung up on itself. So Bobby and I were in the process of saying our goodbyes, and they just decided to shut down on us. So who knows? But nothing really planned this week. I just thought we'd talk about whatever comes to mind. I did have one thing I'd like to pick Bobby's brain about a little bit later on, but first I do have a couple of things to mention. Jerry had asked me before we went on the air if I had any bad news, and I said I do, but it's old bad news. And what that is I just found out day before yesterday that a member of our fraternity passed away last October 24th of last year. And I'm not sure if either one of you guys were familiar with him. He was a referee named Jack Howe.
Oh, my gosh. Are you kidding me?
You know him, Jerry? I thought you might.
Very well. Oh, did he really?
Yeah, his grandson contacted me a couple of days ago and let me know that he had passed away. Because somebody had been, I think Kelly had been asking about him on the Internet. And I wanted some pictures and stuff, so I sent him some stuff of his grandfather. He was living in Arkansas, and I don't know how old he was, but Jack refereed. I know he refereed here in the Mobile Territory in the early 70s, probably 70, 71, 72. He worked for McGirt out in Oklahoma, and then I think he wound up working for Watts in Mid-South. I'm not sure where you worked with him, Jerry.
I worked with him in all of 77 in Louisiana.
Okay, yeah.
Jack was a very good referee.
Very good, yeah, he was a very good referee. Very distinctive. He and Paul Morton were the only ones I ever knew who wore white sneakers with black stripes on. You could always tell one or the other in pictures, even if you couldn't see their face. It either had to be Jack or Bald Eagle, because they wore those white sneakers with the black stripes on them. Did you ever meet him, Bobby, or come across him?
No, never did.
Yeah. But he was...
And you said he passed away?
October 24th last year. And some semi-bad news, but it's actually turning into good news. Mike, the California hippie boyette, had a fall at home on last Friday and broke his hip. He had hip surgery Saturday afternoon. They put a plate and screws in his hip, and he is still in the hospital, but he's actually doing really well. I went and saw him on Tuesday, and, seemed to be doing really well. He's been up and walked a couple of times. He's ready to go home, but they're not... They're not letting him out just yet. I'm sure he'll have to go through some therapy and stuff.
I'm sure they're ready for him to go home.
calm. He was very just sitting up in his chair and just sitting there watching TV when I went in. I don't know if they even allowed him to smoke. I'm not even sure if Mike still smokes. It's been a couple of years since I've seen him. Still went and saw him the other day. And they're keeping him pretty sedated, I think, because of the pain medication, because he was telling me who all had been to see him, and I've talked to a couple of people Tuesday afternoon. They hadn't been to see him yet. He was just sticking their hands.
Well, I was fixing to say, yeah, he's been known to herbally medicate, and he's probably seen several stars.
Stars.
You know.
How old's Mike now?
He was telling the nursing there the other day he was 39, but I said, I think you've laughed that. I'm not sure. I'm sure he's probably in his late 60s.
It has to be.
Because he broke into business in 68 or 69, and he was in the Navy prior to that. So, you know, he's probably mid to late 60s, if not beyond that. I'm not sure. He's one of those always look older than he's been.
Yeah. Bobby, was you ever around him much?
Yeah, I met him one time. And I've told this. I don't know if I've told it on here or not. Maybe I did. But he was working for Gulas up in Tennessee. And we used to bring guys in here to do jobs on Atlanta TV out of Nashville on Saturday mornings. And they sent him down here. And I'd never met him. I was introduced to him, you know, as we were in the back talking, you know, for the show. And we went out in the ring. And of course, it was, you know, I mean, 3 or 4 minutes, whoever he was working with, it was a squash. And he started coughing and gagging, and he come out of the ring, and I thought he was coughing up a lung. I mean, I thought he was dying. He literally had to crawl, I mean, on his hands and knees around, you remember the old station on West Peachtree Street, the little media studio where you had the heels, you know, went out through that little opening, and they had to walk up the hallway and then back around into the dressing room. He literally crawled around that corner and through that door, and I was following him. I mean, I was like, man, you're all right. I thought he was dying. You can't imagine how bad it was. He crawls over to his suitcase and fumbles around and grabs a cigarette and lights it and takes a couple of draws and calms right down.
I'm surprised the boy can still breathe.
I told him, I said, son, that stuff's going to kill you. I mean, he's probably... This is probably ugly to even say. He's not well preserved. He's pickled.
I know.
You know, I mean, that's just, I don't know. It's amazing. These guys take care of themselves and they eat right and do, you know, and you hear about them dropping dead at 38 or 39.
I
and then,
know.
And then there's, you know, some guys just like a Timex, take a licking and keep on ticking.
Well, he has, brother.
Yep. Yeah.
If you go see him, Mike, tell him I said hello anyhow.
I will. I told him I'd go back down and see him sometimes before he gets out. But he's doing as well as can be expected in those circumstances.
Since we're in a free-for-all, let me throw this one at you. I don't know who actually is promoting it. I heard Buff Bagwell was running some shows around Atlanta. He's running one tonight in Hiram, Georgia. And they're running tomorrow night in Norcross, Georgia, and they're running Saturday night in Decatur. Now, if you draw a straight line between all three of them, you got about, what, 35 miles, maybe.
Maybe.
You know, and they're, you know, ringside seats tonight was $40. And Charlie Smith's grandson went over to the show tonight, and he called Charlie, and Charlie called me, and said that the ticket sales wasn't going too briskly, and they were walking through the general admission and said, hey, if you give us extra $5, you can sit at ringside. So.
Well, I just can't imagine who would have been on the card that somebody would pay $40 to see.
Well, there's a few guys. I read about it on the Internet today. They're using a few guys that are, you know, they work for WCW or, you know, at least you had heard of them. I'm really surprised they're not being sued, because on Facebook they said they had WCW and WWE stars. Vince ain't seen it, or they will be. But, you know, no TV. These guys couldn't draw when they were actually on a legitimate TV, and now they think they're going to draw with this. I just...
You know, it's almost pitiful to think you can do it now.
Oh, it's I'm telling you, it's. I admire these independents that run, that draw decent or enough to at least break even. I mean, you know, Jerry, you promoted. It's almost an impossibility to run a promotion of any kind and break even, much less make a dollar.
It's expensive. I mean, I knew it going in, but my gosh. I've decided what I'm going to do. I'm going to try to play professional baseball. I see what these fellas are getting. I'm going to give it a whirl.
I heard that, brother. I heard that.
I figure I got time for spring training to get in shape between now and spring training.
I'm
a good bat boy.
I heard that. I can shag fly balls. I can wait till it hits the fence and quit rolling and pick it up.
It'll do it when they pay you for that.
Jeez.
You never
worked none of those shows we did at the stadium, did you, Jerry? Where we wrestled after the Braves games?
I was in the hospital when they did one when I was here.
We did the first one out there, and before the game, this sounds like you're making this up. This is the absolute truth. Before the game, they had about 20 or 25 couples get married at home plate. And then the Braves played.
I did work one there at one time. Yes, I did. That's when I met Billy Graham for the first time. But go ahead.
Okay. We did the Braves. They did the Braves game, and then we wrestled. We had the ring set up right beside the bullpen down the first baseline. I refereed the first one that they did out there. Hot. Golly, it was hot.
You know,
we had to set the ring up, of course, before the game started, and then that sun beating down on that mat for 3 or 4 hours, and then.
Bobby, how did they keep that thing out of the way?
Well, it was behind the fence. It was in foul territory, but it was behind the fence. Over, they had moved the, they had. It was actually what they turned into a picnic area down the first baseline.
Right, right.
And they put the ring in there.
Whose idea was that? Was that Turner's?
It was Turner's. Yeah, I mean, it was a thing. I mean, the wrestling was to try to draw people to the Braves games. Back in that time frame, our numbers, our ratings on TBS was better than the Braves.
Oh, I'm sure they were.
So we ran wrestling. They run wrestling in there to try to draw, and they did. They drew more people that Sunday than they'd been drawing because people come see the wrestling. And I can remember. I remember the. I didn't have any pictures of that. I mean, I was trying to, you know, I could not remember. And somebody found a program and gave to me. It had a picture of me refereeing a match with Roberto Soto and I want to say Killer Brooks at the stadium. But I remember Stan Stasiak was on the card. Gino Hernandez was on the card, what short time he was here. And a couple other guys. I don't know. We ran 4 or 5 matches. And we recorded it and played some of them back on TV. They flew Gordon in that Sunday, or they kept him over from TV to actually do the commentary.
Well, you're talking about Gino Hernandez. He wasn't here long. He wasn't anywhere long.
Houston.
Well, I mean, he wasn't here on this earth long.
No, he wasn't.
He was a piece of talent too, brother.
When he came in here, if he'd had his head screwed on straight, they would have done something with him here. They tried.
Well, see, that was the thing. He was a piece of talent that just, he was a handsome guy, very handsome, you know, good body, good piece of talent. But my last time I laid my eyes on him was, he was coming into Portland as I was leaving. And I saw him for the last time in Medford, Oregon, when I was leaving. That was my last night there. It was the last time I ever saw him.
Hmm. He came in here. He'd been here about a week, 10 days, and we worked Griffin on Saturday night. And Doug Smith, that's where Doug lived. You remember Doug, Jerry? He used to referee and worked for Barnett in the office. He actually was Barnett's office manager. When he left, I took his place. But when Doug was refereeing, and Doug was salty. I mean, you know, people didn't realize you didn't mess with him. He was very easygoing, but if you hit the wrong side of him, he'd fight a buzzsaw.
He was a sweetheart.
And we were in the ring. Well, we were there. I was there that night, and they had Hernandez figured in some kind of angle they were going to bring back, and he was going to get some blood that night. And Doug went down on a mat to count his shoulders or count the other guy's shoulders or something, and Hernandez just reached over and cut the top of Doug's hand, just trying to be cute. It wasn't so cute when they got back to the dressing room.
Really?
Oh, yeah. It was kind of nasty. Doug clocked him as soon as he come through the door.
Where is Doug now?
Doug, well, what we hear, he's living in Concord. Right there between Griffin and Molina.
I've been through them.
How we used to cut through there. Exactly. And I still go that way when I go see my children. But, where they say he's at. We've tried to Charlie Smith actually talked to him. We tried to get him to come to some of the reunions, and he just doesn't show any interest. We heard that his wife, Maggie, that he'd been married to for quite some time, passed away. And I really don't know what he's doing. I guess he still has his construction company. That's what he was doing last time I talked to him.
He was a nice guy, man.
He was.
Very nice man. I really liked him. He was funny. He was a funny guy. I really liked him.
Well, since he probably ain't listening, we'll talk about him a little bit. When he was managing the office for Barnett, he had this little old girl he was seeing in Atlanta, and she was kind of crazy. So he tried to break it off. And so we're sitting in the office one day, and the mail would come in, and they would shove it in the ticket office up front window, you know, and I'd sort it out. And, you know, the mail that was going to the boys, I'd put in one place. And if it was ticket requests for TV or whatever, I'd put it in another place. And then whatever, you know, business mail, I'd take it back to Doug. Well, I took it back there. Well, yeah, there was one of those probably 8.5 by 11 padded envelopes. You know, it had that, you could tell it had that padding inside of it, that had them air bubbles. I took that thing back there to him, and I heard him scream, and I thought somebody had shot him. And I started out the ticket office, and as I did, he was coming out the back, and he had that envelope in his hand. And when he did, as soon as he came out, the smell hit me in the nose, and I thought somebody had died. And he run out to the front door, and he just throwed that envelope just hard as he could throw it out the front door. That crazy woman had sent him a cow tongue.
Oh, come on, Bobby.
So did. And had some kind of note in there that, you know, she had put some kind of voodoo hex on him or something. I don't know. Yeah, but mailed him a cow tongue. That was a rather interesting piece of mail he got.
I guess he didn't see her anymore.
Oh.
Didn't he live in Griffin?
Yeah, that's where he did live. He lived in Griffin. He sure did. He sure did. He was Barnett's office manager. He would referee Atlanta on Friday nights, and he would referee Griffin on Saturday nights. And every once in a while, he'd go to Macon or somewhere if they needed him to. But Doug had a lot of different irons in the fire. He had a lot of different business ventures he was hooked into, and he promoted for a while. He built a building in Griffin.
Across the street, right?
From the old building.
Why did that happen, Bobby? They sold that building?
What's that, the old building?
Yeah.
Yeah, the old building was, it was owned by, if I'm not mistaken, Gunkel and Paul Jones bought it from Buddy Fuller.
I thought Fuller had owned it at one time.
He originally built it. And,
that was a great building, man.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, when I first started, when I first went to work for Harbin in 68, 69, I put the TV ring up on Saturday, and then Larry Nichols, the guy that I worked with there, we would go to Griffin, and Larry tore tickets there, and I would sell programs. And when we first started going down there, and you probably remember this, it used to be a dirt floor.
It sure did.
They used to have board shows and different things in there. And then whatever year it was, 69 or 70, me and Larry went down there and took that ring down. And that ring had never been taken down, or it had not been down in so long, we had to beat it apart because the dirt and everything had settled in it coming off that floor. We had to beat that thing apart, but we took everything down where they could pave that floor. And then we went back down there and put everything back together.
Do you remember what color that canvas was in that ring? It was purple.
It was purple, yeah. That's what I was fixing to say. It was either blue or purple. It was purple,
right,
wasn't
that's it? That's the first time it was gorgeous.
Yeah. And they had that big, huge light that Fuller had built that light, or had it built. Remember, it had that big, huge, it wasn't a spotlight. It was a, they had a, had a some sort of a shade or fixture built that was almost the size of the ring.
It sure was.
And it was painted white inside, and it had a bunch of different lights all the way around, but it wasn't a big, one single floodlight. It was a bunch of lights, and it lit that whole ring up, and the rest of that building was pretty well dark.
It was. I love wrestling.
It was a great atmosphere.
It was perfect. So they tear that down.
They didn't tear it down. It's still there.
They sold it to a sewing
house. Whoever bought it turned it into some sort of factory. It's a manufacturing factory, and the building is still there.
Well, how did that come about building across the street? Whose doings was that?
That was Doug. Doug had two business partners. And they decided to build a building there, and they approached Barnett. Doug approached Barnett, and Barnett agreed to put wrestling in there on Saturday night on a regular basis. You know, I don't know what the agreement was for a year or whatever, but they built that building, and wrestling was going to be the mainstay every Saturday night.
And it wasn't the same when they moved it across the street.
No, it wasn't. It wasn't the same. It wasn't the same. Doug's building wasn't nearly as big as that other building.
No, it wasn't.
And it just never – he drew some good crowds when we first went down there, but it just never caught on like the building across the street did.
And that's freakish, isn't it? I mean –
yeah. I mean, just
– did you ever go in that building, Mike?
No. I never worked in Griffin. But that the original building there, wasn't that property either adjacent to or on Fuller's land originally? Because didn't he have a ranch out there?
He had a quarter horse ranch there. Yeah, it was right close.
Yeah,
it was somewhere close.
But didn't Lester wind up with it?
Lester was probably involved in it. You know, I mean, that family, when one got involved, they all did. I'm not sure.
I know Roy Lee lived out there at that house behind it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Roy Lee lived there for a while.
Yeah, well, see, if I ain't mistaken, that was Fuller's house originally.
Well, if I remember correctly,
Fuller sold it to Jones and Gunkel. And then I'm not sure what transferred.
Ron and Robert lived out there at one point, because didn't Ron play basketball for Griffin High School?
Probably.
And I'm almost sure I've heard Robert say he went to Griffin High School, so that's how I knew they lived out there. Well, the Fuller's, well, Buddy did the same thing. When they first opened up this territory in 52 in Mobile, they bought that ranch over there in Foxley. And he had, you know, he would have rodeos out there, and he'd have all kind of stuff. And, of course, when he sold the promotion to Lee, that was, from what I've been told, that was kind of a byproduct of buying the ranch. The main thing he wanted to do was sell that ranch off, and he told Lee he'd throw the promotion in with it if Lee would buy the ranch. And they bought that ranch and turned it into the Field Brothers Ranch. It was a big thing out there for years.
When did Buddy open up? When did he go to that territory?
Mobile?
Yeah.
Well, Buddy was, I'm sure he had part of it, but he was more or less the figurehead here. They called him the promoter. All the paperwork was in his name, all the licenses and all that stuff or whatever was needed. But the territory was actually, it belonged to Joe Gunther. Well, Joe Gunther owned Birmingham and he owned New Orleans. Mobile didn't belong to anybody. It was just a stop in between, because this was, you have to remember, this was back in the early 50s before there was any interstate. Mobile was just a layover in between, so Gunther started running in 50 or 51. Well, actually, he ran in the 40s, but he stopped during World War II and then started up again at 50. He ran in 50 and 51, and he was using Nick Adams and Tarzan White were pretty much overseeing the territory, running the territory, booking the guys or whatever. And then midway through 52, Jack Welch and Roy Welch bought Dunford out. They started in Dothan. Dothan was the first town they opened. Then they opened Mobile, Pensacola, and just expanded from there. And they brought Buddy first came in 53 as a worker. He and Lee and Don Field, Tyler Fields family guy, all involved here. It's like Bobby said, once one member of the family got involved, they all did. And Buddy was announced as the promoter in 55, I think. And he was the promoter of record until he sold out to Lee. And of course, you know, they would do things like they'd bring in a different promoter if Buddy wanted to get involved with an angle or something like that. They'd say that he's turned over the promotership or promotion to, I think they used Rocky McGuire quite a bit. A guy by the name of Leroy Morris, where I don't know how Leroy fit into all that, but he was involved in it. Les Wolf, if you've ever heard that name, not Buddy Wolf, the wrestler, but Les Wolf, who was in with Doulas and Welch in Tennessee, would come down here periodically.
Well, when did Lee take over?
Lee bought him out in December of 1959 and officially started promoting in January 1960. And, of course, he did the same thing. You know, when territories get down, he'd want to wrestle. He'd, you know, bring in, you know, Rocky McGuire or whoever and say, this is the promoter. That would allow him, because the Boxing and Wrestling Commission, those type of people weren't smart. So, you know, of course, it was illegal for somebody to promote and be talent. So that's why they did that. And that's the same way it was in Georgia with Paul Jones. Dunkel and Fuller actually own the majority of the territory. They use Paul Jones' name for the same reason. But Bobby was talking about earlier, the things like the Braves game and getting, you know, mail for the boy. All that stuff sounds hokey now, but that just tells you how much a local promotion was part of the community back in those days. You know, that they got involved in stuff like that. The guys actually, you know, there was an office for guys to get fan mail, where you go down and buy tickets and stuff like that. How many of Vince's guys do you think actually get
fan mail? We've talked about this before, Michael, but Jerry can attest to this, and he probably better than me. But I'm going to tell you something. There was no telling how much money was made in Macon, Columbus, and Albany, Georgia. And as hokey as Fred Ward came off, Fred Ward was believable as a promoter in those towns, and people bought that hokey act. I'm not sure it was an act. I think that was Fred.
That was him.
I mean, he would come out on TV wearing a Shriner's fez and promote the circus. You know, and his catchphrase, or it wasn't a catchphrase, he really meant it, but he started the same show every week with the same thing. Hello to all my sick and shut-in friends.
And hope they'll be up and at them real, real soon.
Real, real soon. Yes, sir.
But he was a powerful man in Columbus, Georgia.
Yes, he was.
Very powerful.
And, you know, I tell you another, and this is, I don't even remember the guy's name. Remember the guy on Macon TV? His little deal was people.
Do I remember him?
I never quite understood what people was all about, but that was his deal, and people bought it.
It was catchy. It was.
Hello,
I can see him, but I can't think of his name, Bobby.
It's just local promotions were, they were catered to the area in which they were, you know. It was
so personable because, you know, no matter where Mr. Ward went in town, the fans would come up to him, I want to see so-and-so, meet so-and-so, and I
yep.
mean, it was,
yep.
it had a personal appeal to it. It really did.
That kind of leads into what I was going to pick Bobby's brain about. And Jerry, you probably are, because I know you were around Fred Ward quite a bit and everything, but how did they go about setting up their television? But say somebody starts a promotion here, how did they, did the promoter himself approach, you know, a certain television station, or did they have, I know by the time you got into the office, Freddie Miller was doing the stuff for Barnett, but prior to that, Bobby, do you know whether or not Gunkel actually went around and...
When I was a kid, Michael, growing up, wrestling in Atlanta was on Channel 11. And the first wrestling I remember ever watching was live. It was 6:30 to 7:30 every Saturday night. And as I got older and they started moving it around. Some weeks it would be on at 11:30. Some weeks it would be on at midnight. Some weeks it would be on at 3 in the afternoon. It was never at the same time. And what happened was the Channel 11 started, you know, I mean, I didn't know. I was just a kid looking for the wrestling, couldn't find it, you know. And it was moving around. Well, what I learned later on after I actually started, you know, being around the office and listening and I learned listening, you could learn a whole lot. But the thing was, is what happened, Gunkel got hot at Channel 11 because they were moving it around. The houses started going up and down because people couldn't find the TV. I mean, it didn't matter how important or how hot the angle was. If people couldn't see it on the TV, they didn't know about it. So that's what led to wrestling moving to Turner Station. Turner came into Atlanta and he bought Channel 17, a little UHF station, and UHF was very new in the Atlanta market. I mean, there was no 36, 46. I mean, there was, you know, I mean, we're talking days before cable where there was ABC, NBC, and CBS. If you're lucky, you could pick up a PBS station. Well, he came in and bought this channel, 17, and he cut the deal with Gunkel. And I don't know what the deal was, but we were like the Baltimore Colts. Me and Larry went up to Channel 11 and moved that ring in the middle of the night. And we took it down there and put it inside 17. And the first Saturday, the very first Saturday, that I went to Channel 17 to put the ring up, I couldn't get nobody to come to the back door. I beat and I beat and I beat it. I mean, we're talking, it's 8 o'clock in the morning, you know, and we didn't tape till, I don't know, 11:30. And I'm beating on the door and I can't get anybody to the door. So finally I had to use my pocket knife and I jimmied the door and I got it open. And I went down through there and I wasn't real sure where I knew where to go to put the ring up, but I wasn't sure. I wanted to make sure somebody knew I was in the building. So I cut through and I found the control room. And there was a guy at Channel 17. He was sitting there. He was barefooted. He had a guitar. He was smoking a joint. And he was running the control board. That was Channel 17, the first time I ever went there. I mean, it was a strange setup. I mean, Channel 11, you know, was an ABC affiliate at the time. And it was pretty, you know, straightforward and businesslike. But this was a whole new ballgame. And another thing that Turner did the week Gunkel moved it over there, Turner owned a station in Charlotte. He went on TV in Charlotte. We don't know if he was drunk or what he was doing, but he went on TV in Charlotte and told people in Charlotte he was going broke, and he asked everybody watching his channel to send him $1. He said, if you send me $1, you'll help me get over the hump. No more, just $1 a piece. He said, and I'll pay you back. And Harbin told me Gunkel liked had a stroke when he heard about that, because he had just put his lifeline in Turner's hand.
Well, it worked out, didn't it?
The rest is history, my boy, as they say.
Turner was a mad genius.
he would go before Jane Fonda. I would be in there putting a TV ring. I'd be putting the ring up on Saturday morning, and I'd hear something. You know, I mean, I'd hear a noise or something. And this one particular Saturday, it was kind of loud, and I didn't know what it was. So I decided to go look, and I wound up upstairs, wandering around, following the sound, and I wound up in Turner's office, and he was drunk, and he was under the desk. And he couldn't get up because he kept hitting his head on the desk and he couldn't figure it out. And he never saw me. I just pulled the door to and right back downstairs I went. But it was a fun place to be back then.
I read an interview with him right after I moved to Atlanta in the early 80s. He was a Christian president, get all the way to the campus of Fort Jane Bobby. You can spot him. He'd be down there. The owner parked with his green blazer on and no socks. And that's what he said his goal in life was to have enough money where he never had to wear a necktie, never had to wear socks. But then Fred Wolf ran, how many televisions? He ran Macon, Columbus, and what, Albany?
No, Albany didn't have a TV.
Albany was a tape when it finally went in there. They finally did get TV in there, but it was a tape. They never did a live show there. But Albany ran off of Columbus TV.
You know what, Drew? Was that Ralph Allison skating rink?
Yes, sir.
My gosh. Of course, it wasn't a civic center there or nothing, you know. But my goodness. Thursday nights? You remember that, Bobby?
Yes, sir. And it was a dump. I mean, he built this skating ring in an old industrial part of Albany, and he actually had a hardwood floor. But he built bleachers, and he would bring bleachers in and set them up. So he basically had a little arena there. I mean, there was bleachers on all four sides plus ringside seats, but we dressed the baby faces had a plywood dressing room built in the. Heels dressed in the room where they rented the skates out.
But you know, I don't know how many people that thing would seat, but you couldn't hardly walk to the ring.
Oh, yeah.
Well, Jerry, you worked in Panama City, right? They had the same thing, the rainbow.
Yeah, I worked in Panama City.
Sort of the rainbow arena, and it was the same thing. It was built onto a skating rink. That building was. It started out as an outdoor. And they finally put a roof on it because they were losing so much during the summer with all the rains and then they were canceling so many shows. They finally put a roof on it.
Did Panama City ever do big business?
Yeah. Well, I mean, they ran that Rainbow Arena with, I don't know how much it held, probably 1,000, 1,200 people, but it would pack out. If you listen to Bernie Jones in his suit interview, he said that he and Billy Hines sold that building out for 10,000 people. I don't know how they did it.
Who said that?
Bernie Jones.
Oh, okay. The beach draws real well over there, Jerry.
The beach?
Yeah, it draws real well.
Well, they tried a couple of times that they had a floating ring floated out. They had that in Miami, too, didn't they? Did you ever work that one in Miami?
I worked in Miami. I've never been in a floating ring.
I've heard Dick's told stories about working in that floating ring. And I think Donnie Fargo's told some, too, about hiding booze under the ring.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And going out on the top rope, swimming under the ring.
I may have told you this, Jerry. We was talking about Albany. I don't know if I have or not. If I have, you can stop me. But Ricky Gibson showed up there one night, and he was sick. And he couldn't breathe. And he was sitting in the dressing room, and he had a bottle of that Vicks Sinex, and he was trying to make you know, he'd get that stuff up in there, and he'd breathe, and then he'd be talking like this, because, he was so stuffed up, he couldn't breathe. And he told me, he said, I don't know if I can work or not. He said, I can't breathe. And he said, I have to use this stuff, or I just can't breathe. And he said, I don't know what I'm going to do, and I forget who he's working with. So before the first match that night, I took some white tape and put on my hand, taped it up and went out and refereed with that white tape on. And when it got time for Ricky's match, which was second or third match, I come back in the dressing room and I put another string of that white tape around my hand, but I left it real loose. And I took that bottle of Sinex and stuck it down inside my hand in my palm. And we went out and worked the match. And every time he got to where he couldn't breathe, I'd have whoever he was working with give him in a front face lock and take him straight down. And I'd get down there like I was checking for a choke, and I'd run my hand under there. And he'd pull that Sinex out and take a shot or two and then stick it back in the tape.
Well, I wish you'd have carried some when I was out there. How's Ricky doing?
Ricky's dead.
He's dead.
He is dead. He died, what, Mike, 5 years ago, 6 years ago?
6 years ago, yeah.
Oh, come on.
Yeah.
No. Didn't know that, dude.
God.
Yeah. That's where did they ever determine whether his wife found him out by the pool? I don't know if they determined that he had a heart attack or what it was, but yeah.
Was he by the pool or in the pool? I can't remember.
I think he was in the pool.
He was in the pool. That's what I remember, yeah.
Didn't he get in a bad wreck and was all crippled up?
Yes, yes.
On a cane.
He was on a cane and barely getting around. And
yeah.
That's another one that abused himself.
Yes, sir.
He was a good piece of talent, though.
I was fixing to say, what a worker, though.
He was one of the most natural workers I've ever seen in my life. I mean, just
who broke him in the business?
His dad or stepdad or somebody worked for the Fields in Louisiana. I think he put up the ring and did the ring truck or whatever, but that was back when Billy Golden was down there with him and he was doing the booking. And Ricky and Jimmy Golden were kids together, and they would go around putting out the posters in all the towns that they did. And I don't know who actually trained him. I know they worked an angle here that Bob Kelly was his trainer here, but I think, you know, Ricky, I would imagine, you know, the Welcher, Golden, you know, all those kind of
things. Well, where all did he go?
He worked here. He worked Georgia. He worked Florida. He worked in Tennessee for Gulas and for Jared. He worked in Kansas City.
Did he really?
Yeah. He worked in Dallas briefly toward the end of his career. And when the Rock and Roll Express were so hot for Crockett, they brought him into Crockett, but they had him using the name Ricky Lee Jones, and he was doing jobs. And then, of course, he had his rent. Well, he worked for Fuller. He worked for Fuller in Knoxville and here. But he worked in several places. The only places I know he worked on top was Kansas City, Tennessee, and here.
When was he in Kansas City?
79, maybe. I think he was a Central State champion, I think, for a brief period of time.
I can't even tell you the last time I saw Ricky.
But, yeah, he would dabble in stuff around here. I know he got involved with a promotion, a local promotion in Pensacola sometime late 90s, early 2000s. He and I think Lucas were doing their ring announcing, and Ricky was supposed to be their commissioner or whatever. But it didn't last very long. It only lasted a few weeks or so. But he's been dead at least 5 years, if not longer.
He comes to the reunion every year there in Mobile. We'd sit and talk every year, you know, a little bit, but he was just he was in bad shape last time I saw him.
Was he living in Pensacola?
Yeah.
As far as I know, he was still over there.
Yeah, he was living outside of Pensacola. It's in Canton or somewhere like that. It was in the Pensacola area. His son has got a website up. He's RichGibson.com or GibsonBrothers.com or something like that. But did you ever see him, he and Spears work each other?
I didn't know.
Now that was I know in Georgia, Soto and Spears had a hellacious feud going, but in here, that was it for them working with Spears. That lasted for years, and they cooled it off, and you know they would work each other for a year or so, and then all of a sudden they hooked up again, and it never stopped, and it never failed to draw. They were made for each other. They just did as far as.
Now, we've never run Spears down. Is that correct?
No. Nobody I know where he is. Nope.
It's weird.
Because I got a call on the line. I'm gonna get on with us. Let me see who this is. I have something interesting to talk to us about. Caller from Area Code 615, you're on there, go ahead.
Hey guys, it's Frank Vendries, how's it going?
All right, how's it going?
Hey, good evening.
Good evening, guys. Well, I got a horrible head cold, and I got to go to work, but after hearing about cow tongues being sent in the mail and Vicks inhalers in the ring, you guys made my day. Thank you.
I'm sorry your day is going that bad.
That perked it up, Jerry. A cow tongue in the mail. I can say that's honestly never happened. Never had a girl love me enough to send me a cow tongue, so I'm doing something really right or really wrong once. So I don't know. Just real quick. Go ahead, Mike.
Real. I was going to say the best package I know of is one that Dick Bockwinkel sent Charlie Smith one time. I don't know if you can tell
that one
on Instagram.
Oh, jeez.
What was that?
Charlie had Nick bring it, send him, you know, Nick was going to Japan, so Charlie asked him to get him a watch. And guys used to get, you know, you could get a Seiko at the Tokyo Hilton had a Seiko store, and you could get one for, you know, pennies on the dollar compared to what you pay for them here. So Charlie gets a box in the mail, and when he gets it and he opens it up, it's a big wad of feminine sanitary type product, and it's covered in ketchup and hot sauce, and he had to unwrap all of that to get to his watch. So that was Bockwinkel said he couldn't think of a nicer guy to send it to. So
I guess maybe it was that Timex of the month, huh?
That's a good one. Let's see, Bobby, how kind was I to you when I brought you your boots back?
You were very kind.
You guys, obviously, you know about the new Bill Dundee book, correct?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
I'm not finished with it yet, but I was reading Bill's book, and I want to just read a real short excerpt from the book and get your guys' opinion on this, okay? Bill is talking about the short time when Jerry Jarrett and Ole Anderson agreed to let Bill have a TV show in Chattanooga and run some towns in Georgia and only shut it down after 5 or 6 weeks. And this is Bill talking about Ole Anderson. He said he just hated everything and was not going to let this Chattanooga thing work because he was stuck in the Stone Ages. I really believe if Ole would have let our plan go on, it would have taken off. We could have helped him with his TBS show and the national tours if he would have not been so close-minded and stubborn. Maybe, just maybe, his company would have started making money. Maybe his partners, Jack and Jerry Briscoe, would have been happy. Maybe they would have not have sold their percentage to Vince McMahon. Maybe if Ole would have not have lost his company, maybe Vince McMahon would not be able to run the world. Unfortunately, Ole thought he was the smartest man in wrestling and he was going to do whatever he wanted to do. So my question is, do you guys think that Ole Anderson indirectly had anything to do with, or directly, anything to do with Vince McMahon running the world?
I would say so.
But I know I didn't say it was a light question. So
I think Bill's got a good point. I think it had only, you know, been willing to spread out a little bit more and use the power of TBS a little bit more, like his partners, being Briscoe, wanted him to. But on the old age, he was stuck in that mindset of, you know, honoring other people's territories. But they were already starting to go into, and Bobby can tell us people as better than I can, they were always starting to go up north. Of course, the sheep had run, you know, in a couple of years when they started going up that way. I think so. I mean, I don't know. Everything I've heard, I've never saw the shows that Jared was doing in Chattanooga. But I think the difference is the Georgia product was so different from the Tennessee product. I mean, it's like night and day. I mean, the Tennessee stuff was so gimmicky and so, you know, everything was a brawl and tables and chairs, and, you know, scalpel matches and all that type of stuff. And those workers just, it wasn't a good fit for what Ole was trying to do. So maybe that's the way Ole looked at it. I don't know. Bobby, were you still there when all that happened?
No, I had left. I can see, you know, I was around Ole Anderson a lot, and I worked with him and for him for a long time. And he, Ole was a control freak. It was going to be his way or no way. And he unfortunately owned the company, and he, you know, whether Jack and Jerry would have been happy, I kind of doubt it. The writing was, I mean, at this particular point in time, the writing was on the wall. Vince did not want to buy the Georgia promotion. Vince wanted that TV.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah.
That's all he wanted. And he, you know, he had approached Ole, and Ole, in no uncertain terms, told Vince what to do and where to get off. And Vince told Ole, said, "You will never work for me." And Ole has said this to me himself. He said, "If I had known that he was actually going to pay the kind of money he was promising, I would have been a lot nicer to him." But, you know,
it was
whether the Tennessee thing, whether the Chattanooga show would have took off, whether it would have been successful, yes, maybe for a while it might have. I don't know. It had no bearing on what Vince did. Vince had his eyes set on what he was going to do. It was going to happen. He had the money to make it happen. And you know, as far as Jack and Jerry was concerned, even though they had a lot of points in this Atlanta office, you know, Ole was pretty much, you know, I mean, it was what Ole wanted or it wasn't. And that was, you know, I mean, out of all the people that had percentage points in the Atlanta office, the only people that actually got any money when it all shut down and went away was Jack and Jerry Briscoe. And to their credit, you got to give them credit. They were smart enough to do what they had to do.
But running Chattanooga didn't stop anything. Wouldn't have stopped anything.
No.
It was going to happen. It wasn't, like you said, it wasn't going to be stopped.
Well, another thing is too, and it part of what Bobby was saying is indicative of it. You know, all the promoters, and we talked about this on before, and Ray Gunkel not died, and, you know, had he lived long enough to maybe he and Pete Graham team up, they could stop anything. Same thing as, you know, when Jim Crockett was still alive.
That's the only way it ever happened.
You get that many different promoters. You know, you get headstrong people like Anderson, Bill Watts. I'm sure Eddie Graham was the same way. I never worked for him. Jerry did, so you know. But you have that many personalities and that many egos, it's not going to work. I mean, they tried it with Jarrett and Fritz and Vern Gagne.
Yeah.
And yeah, you get egos in the way, and people who are so used to always having their way and always having the final say. So if they're not willing to bend enough and see enough that they needed each other enough to make things happen, you know, there's no stopping anything. One thing I will say, I think had Sam Mustick been a younger man when all this was happening or still been alive, I don't think that's what it is. Mustick had control over the NWA enough where he kept all the promoters in line and had them agree enough that I think that he would have been the only one that could have fought Vince by himself.
I think it's just like Bobby said, it was about that TV, you know, that Superstation PBS TV was so powerful, and if somebody would have controlled that that would have maybe been a younger man or would have had the foresight to understand where cable TV was going, and maybe not even so much went against the territories, made everybody see where this thing was going, what we have to do, things would have been different. But, boy, that, you know, it's hard to see ahead like that, too.
Well, another thing, and maybe I'm naive or oversimplifying this. Even if you control the TV, okay, and we've talked about this on here before, and where this is right, wrong, nobody's ever going to know. But let's say, for instance, we four people inherit the superstation, and we've got it, and we've got this huge satellite that'll blast all over the country. You can't run a promotion that's going to draw on a consistent basis using one nationwide TV. I mean, you're going to book six matches with six different angles, and you're going to run it in San Francisco tonight. You're going to run it in Portland the next night. You're going to run it in Boise, Idaho the next night. At some point, you got to bring them back to do something on TV again. And it's almost impossible. How are you going to follow it up? I mean, the bottom line is to make money, and back then the money was made in the house shows.
Right.
Here again, I'm not sure Ole or me or Jerry Oates or anybody else saw the power that the money was not going to be made in the houses. It was going to be made on pay-per-views.
That's right.
We didn't see that. We didn't know about that. And you could not run a promotion using that TV. I mean, we were very successful when we first started doing those tours. There's a lot of behind-the-scenes things that you know, Ole talked about in his book, but I've got a different perspective on it. You know, Ole was not only that way with the talent and with the people that he promoted, he was that way with TV people. If the TV people at the stations didn't talk like he wanted them to talk, he felt like, well, it's against the law for you to talk to me that way. I'm paying you to do this. And them station managers were saying, take a hike. And here comes Vince McMahon in there in a three-piece suit going, hi, my name's Vincent J. McMahon or whatever his name
right.
is, Kennedy or whatever. And he says,
yep.
I'm a businessman, and here's my show, and it's top quality production. I want to put it on your station. I'll give you $500 a week to run it. And the station manager says, welcome to my station. And
yep.
that's exactly what happened. You know,
yep. Well,
my wife is sitting here whispering in my ear, and she probably has the best statement that's ever. Let me preface this by saying this. I like Ole Anderson. I like Alan Rogowski better. You have to get by Ole to get to Alan, and that's tough sometimes. But I always respected Ole. But my wife's giving me this line, and it's very true. Ole was his own worst enemy. And if you were ever around him, you can agree with that, I think.
Yeah, I've never been around him, never will be, but, you know, just as a fan, reading so much in all the books and all the stories. And even now it's interesting, you know, with the Four Horsemen going into the Hall of Fame, but no Ole Anderson. And, man, you know, if that goes back
to the conversation between him and Vince.
Right, that's what I'm saying. You know,
and if he invited Ole, Ole wouldn't go, I can tell you that.
It's like, in some ways, that was like a history changing conversation. You know, it's kind of interesting. So
yeah.
Anyway, guys, I got to jump off. Thanks a lot for all the comments, and thanks a lot for the great shows every week.
Thanks, man. Thanks for calling.
Bye bye.
But again, that goes back to what I was saying about television. Back in the old days, stage, you know, the television paid you guys, right? For the tape, for some programming or whatever. Was that how it worked, Bobby?
I'm sorry, do what I... You're breaking up a little bit on me.
Back in... Going back, say, when Uncle first started going with TV and his television stations and all that, did the promotion not get paid by the television? Did the television stations not pay them? Programming.
When we did the deal we had in Atlanta, okay, they swapped us the production time for the product.
Okay.
We gave them, they let us do our TV show at Channel 17. They were allowed to sell all the commercial time, and whatever money they made off that was theirs. We got X number of minutes. I want to say it was 8 minutes out of the 58 that we could use as commercial time to promote a specific product. You know, I mean, we were, if you think back to the Georgia shows, Gordon would say, you know, we got fan mail today from Douglas, Georgia, and we got fan mail from Carrollton, Georgia, and we got fan mail from Albany, Georgia. Well, it just so happened that week we were running Carrollton and Albany and Douglas. But he couldn't specifically say. And then you would get to a point in the show where somebody would come out and say, Wrestling 2 was the greatest at it. He'd come out and go, Carrollton, 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 tonight. You know, that was, but that was what we had. But no, there was no money exchanged between us and TBS. That was production for the
deal for the TBS because the ratings were so high.
They were, listen, they were selling. What people saw in Atlanta was a commercial for Joe's used car lot up on Buford Highway. But on that satellite, they were seeing Budweiser, King of Beer, Coca-Cola. It's the real thing. They were selling national spots, Delta Airlines. I mean, they were selling big-time commercial spots and making money.
It's no telling what they made off of that two-hour show.
No, 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 and no way to know. But when Michael turned that right around, and like, for instance, when we would bicycle our show into Augusta, we paid Augusta whatever it was to run that show every week.
Okay.
We paid them, it was $250, $300 a week. But the station still got to sell the commercial time. All we got was our whatever 8 minutes, and that was true with stations all over the country, West Virginia, Columbus, Ohio, wherever it was that we ran a local station. We
now
had to pay for that time.
Freddie Miller used to do. Where did they come in? Were they part of that 8 minutes of advertising? Because he would do a rundown of the Omni, usually the Omni card.
Do the Omni card. But also, we would, as we bicycle those tapes, we would go over on Tuesday mornings and we would do interviews to insert into the tapes for whatever city it was going to, for Augusta, for Bell Auditorium, for Savannah, for the Civic Center, for where at Chattanooga, you know, wherever the tape was going, we would do the spots for that. So it was... It just depended on, you know, I mean, it was a, one thing too is Freddie Miller, one of Freddie's things, and Freddie owned his own company called Freddie Miller Advertising. And when an advertising agency calls and buys commercial time at a TV station, they will give that advertising agency a break on the price so that the advertising agency can, whatever the difference is in whatever their discount is, they can charge that back to the client, and that's how the advertising agency makes money. And we eventually caught on to that. And after Freddie left working for Barnett, we actually opened up our own advertising agency, which was nothing more than a telephone number. And but that we could get that same discount and just save that money.
I know when people first started watching.
Michael.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's Jerry. Is he fading out on you?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, you're getting real low, Mike. I can barely hear you at times.
Okay. How about now?
That's better.
Okay. And what I was saying was when cable first came to Mobile in 78, 77, 78, whatever it was, when I would watch the Georgia show, the only commercials I ever saw were for Slim Whitman albums and some sort of Ronco product. So. Not all the major cities. National commercial.
Zamfir and the pan flute.
Zamfir the
Oh man, it seemed like for years that Georgia Championship Wrestling and Slim Whitman were hand in hand to me all the time I saw them on the cable here. Now, Jerry, when you were promoting in Columbus, I know eventually you guys had a 30-minute program. Were you still promoting there? Was that the group that took over?
No, I was doing that.
You were?
Yes. You know what that cost?
Uh-uh.
$1,000 a week.
Wow. Now, were you to the local? I know it was taped there in your building, though, right?
Yeah, we taped.
You'd have to hire a local crew to come in.
We had our own stuff. And we did it. Then we had to put the interviews in it, and just like the before, and get the finished product. And we had so much time in it, and give it to the station. But you know, getting good times was hard. It was like Saturday mornings, and you know, you couldn't get a. They was gonna put us on like in, you know, on, in the afternoons. But if it was a horse race on or something, some national thing, you'd get bumped. And I'd just rather had a locked in time. Like Bobby was talking earlier, you start getting bumped. They don't know when it's going to be on.
So that's one of the things that helped kill this territory down here before when Lee sold it to Fuller. They lost, they were on Channel 3 in Pensacola, at least for the Mobile Pensacola, and Dothan was still doing taping live, or not taping live, that's actually more on it. They were still broadcasting live on Saturday afternoons. And they started out with three stations in Mississippi. They did TV Hattiesburg, Gulfport, and Meridian, I believe it was. But they had finally cut down and were just taping on Friday mornings, I think it was, in Hattiesburg, and they were bicycling that tape around. But they started, after they lost Channel 3 here, and I'm not sure why that came about or how that happened, but after several years, they no longer had Channel 3, so they signed back with Channel 5, which was where they originally started doing TV in the 50s. But they couldn't set up in a studio. They didn't have a studio they could do, so they taped the matches from the Expo Hall, and they would edit it into several TV shows. So the angles, you really couldn't follow the angles. And again, it came back to what Bobby was saying. They didn't have a set time. They'd be on sometimes at midnight following a movie, or they'd be on at 1:30 in the morning, or they'd be on at 3 o'clock in the morning, or they'd be on at 5 o'clock in the afternoon. They didn't have a set time.
Oh, that'll shoot you right in the foot, you know.
And if you can't find it, you know, it's just like if you were running a promotion and for 10 years you ran on Wednesday nights, and then all of a sudden, you know, it was, you run on Wednesday nights, you run on Friday nights, you run on Saturday, you know, you're going to lose, you know, people are going to stop following you. I mean, it just makes sense. But that's one of the things that killed this territory down here.
Was the Dothan TV, that was live, wasn't it?
It was live up until 76. No, 77. They finally dropped, since they had such a hard time with WKRG here in Mobile, they started doing all the TV in Dothan. And we were bicycling that tape. They put in local interviews for Mobile or Pensacola or whatever, but everything was off that TV. And they started taping it at that point.
Yeah, when I was at... When was I there, Michael? 77, 78?
77.
I don't know. You know more about it than I do. When I went in there, they would tape the show in the afternoon because we would go to New Brockton that night. I'd leave there and I'd go over to the mall and I'd generally eat at the Piccadilly, and then I'd walk around to Sears and stand in Sears and watch the tape.
It was taped in Dothan that afternoon.
Taped in Dothan that afternoon, and they played it back like at 5:30. In Dothan, and I would walk around in Sears to the TV department, and I'd stand there and watch tape, and then I'd go to New Brockton.
Did you pull up a lounge chair or something?
No, I never did pull up a lounge chair, but...
We used to do that. We'd go, when Fuller did the same thing. They taped in Dothan Saturday morning at 11 o'clock, and we would do that. We would go to the TV show and then go, like Bobby said, we'd go to Piccadilly at the one mall that was in Dothan at the time, and go to Sears, and we'd all pile up on a couch or an easy chair or something and sit there once they were running the show at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, on Saturday afternoon. But we didn't have to go in. When Fuller was running, they ran Dothan on Saturday night, so we take TV, you know, Saturday morning and stay in Dothan at the Farm Center Saturday night. So,
That was the only time the furniture department in Sears was full. It was always full of a bunch of wrestlers up there watching themselves on TV. It was just the job guys. The stars all had hotel rooms so they could watch themselves in private. They weren't doing something else. But there'd be, you know, six or seven job guys sitting in the furniture department in Sears watching themselves.
So Phil, did Fuller run that? I'm talking about Ron. He runs the whole territory off of that Dothan TV.
Yes. Yeah. They take the show in Dothan, but they ran it on a local Mobile channel, which covered Mobile and Pensacola. Of course, Dothan covered over Panama City when they were still running Panama City. But when he closed Knoxville and moved his base of operations down here totally, he expanded into Montgomery, Huntsville briefly, and Birmingham. And so he would run that same tape, that show it in Dothan, show it in Mobile, show it in Birmingham, and show it in Montgomery. And it would cover the whole thing. Again, with the same thing, they cut local interviews for, you know, whatever was happening locally. But usually, other than Pensacola, he ran the same angle, same matches in all the towns except Pensacola.
When I first went to work for Barnett in November of 74, I guess it was, they were doing... Of course, they took Ann's hour there on Saturday night. They did 2 hours in Atlanta. Columbus TV was live. And then on Tuesdays, Ralph Freed, who was Fred's son-in-law, had a production crew there that, you know, at the arena in Columbus. They would bring their production crew, and we would tape an hour show at the sports arena on Tuesdays. And they would have... One set of announcers would be doing the show for Augusta, and one set of announcers would be doing the show for Savannah, and one for Albany. They had three different crews there that were doing the shows. And it was the same show, but three different announcers, and they all went to a specific city. Maybe one was for Savannah. I can't remember. But they were, you know, they were, when they were doing that, and we were doing great business. I mean, this is when Tanaka was here, and Wrestling 2, and they were doing their thing, and I can't remember who else was here at the time, but the deal was is the shows, each city got a unique show, where it wasn't the Atlanta show bicycling all the way around. At that time, they were sending different tapes to different places, and it was, I always thought that was a great idea. I don't know what the cost was to do the production that way, but that just always seemed like a great thing. And we had that stupid building sitting there, and they'd charge people $1 to get in, and we always had 100 people there on Tuesday. I mean, I don't know where these people came from. It didn't have to work or whatever, and it was always better in the summer when kids were out of school, but it was kind of an interesting concept, and it seemed to work, and then all of a sudden we quit, and they just started using the Atlanta tape.
It's funny how you find your own niche in something, isn't it?
You tell me, that was the same building that they take Columbus TV in?
No, this was Sports Arena in Atlanta.
Oh, okay. You threw me there. I was going to say, I know that building.
See, Paul Jones had the Sports Arena in Atlanta. That building would hold about 3,000 people. And he used to have square dances there and country western music on Friday and Saturday night. And then if the auditorium was unavailable, this was before the Omni was built, they'd have the matches at the Sports Arena there in Atlanta. And the thing about the Sports Arena, a lot of family people wouldn't go to the Sports Arena because they had a pretty bad reputation, and also they sold alcohol there, which is something they didn't do at the City Auditorium. But, you know, I mean, I ushered there, I worked there, and, of course, spent many years in the office there till we moved to the Omni, but it was a great building. I mean, that building had a heck of a history. It was originally built in 1940 something by the Warren Company because they had a female professional basketball team, and he built it. It was called the Warren Arena, and he built it for that basketball team.
Oh,
Is it still there, Bobby?
No, they tore it down. It's gone. But they had that's the first building Elvis Presley ever performed in Atlanta. It's the first building Kenny Rogers ever performed in. I mean, they used to, there was a lot of folks passed through there.
Yeah, it's amazing if you dig around. Mobile does not have that many places. Most of the places they ran matches here are still in existence. The big city auditorium is still here. The Expo Hall, which is where they moved to in 73, is adjacent there. This is this is where Bobby worked his magic. But the original building that they started running wrestling here in Mobile down the docks, it was called the Wharf Arena. And it was at the foot of Dolphin and Canal Street, if I'm not mistaken. They were right there on the docks. But they moved that. They ran in there in the 30s and 40s, but they moved the building in the late 40s to behind the building that belonged to the Shriners, and it became the Shrine Auditorium, the corner of Government and George Street. And that building's still there. The building is still where they put it for the Shrine Auditorium. And that's where they were running, but it belonged to the Shriners, so whatever the deal was, the Buddy Fuller quit doing business with them because the Shriners wouldn't let black patrons in. So he moved from the Shrine Auditorium to Fort Whiting in 55, and they ran in Fort Whiting until 1970 when they moved to the big auditorium. And that building is still there. They ran at Ladd Stadium. The only thing that's not here anymore is where they ran outdoor shows in the summertime at Hartwell Field, which is where the original Mobile Bears played back in the 50s and 60s, and that stadium has been demolished. It's a grazing field for the mounted police forces now. The lot is still there, but the stadium is not there. Not that you guys are interested in all that, though. Shrine Auditorium, it's actually a neat place. I went over there right after I moved back to Mobile, and it's now owned by a private citizen, but he uses the build the Shrine House. It sits in front of the auditorium. He does catered affairs there and stuff, weddings, wedding receptions and stuff like that. He told me I could go by there anytime I wanted to look around at that whole building and see if I could find anything. I've never been back over there. I'd be interested to see if they had any kind of posters or anything like that. He said he cleaned a lot of that stuff out and never came across anything like that. All he ever found was some, like, ledgers and stuff. I don't know, but that given what Bobby said, what made me think about this is that building was the first place Elvis Presley played in Mobile, Shrine Auditorium.
You know, it's amazing the city of Atlanta, as big a city as it is and has been, and of course continues to grow, has no more facilities here for those kind of events than we do. We went to Huntington, West Virginia when we were running, when we first started doing those little things up there. And in Huntington, West Virginia, in about a 2-mile stretch, Huntington, West Virginia has two main streets. One's one way going one way, and the other one's one way coming back. They have what they call the field house there, and it'll probably hold 4,500, something like that. That was the first place I ever worked up there. Then you've got Marshall University, which has a huge field house, and it'll hold, 6,000-7,000 maybe. And then they've got a civic center that's not a mile away, and if you use the whole building, it'll hold 12,000. And you know, the city of Atlanta had the city auditorium, which would hold 5,500. And then you had the sports arena that was old and dilapidated, and it would hold 3,000, and eventually they quit using it for anything because the upkeep was too high. And that was pretty much it. The only other arena you had in Atlanta was the Alexander Memorial Coliseum, which belonged to Georgia Tech, where they played basketball, and they wouldn't rent it out.
Yeah, that was it.
That was it. And when the Omni came along, and of course it was an 18,000 seat venue for certain events for wrestling, it'd hold about 16,500, 16,600. It was either oversized or it was undersized. I mean, there was no in between.
They never ran the Omni more than a month, did they?
When they first opened it, they ran it. This was 1973, I guess, after the split. I think they ran it 3 weeks in a row. This is, of course, Georgia Championship. I was working for Ann. But they ran it 3 weeks in a row because the middle week I was off and I went over there. The mark here, Bobby Simmons, went over there because they had San Martino on the card and I had heard so much about him I wanted to see him. And I went over and watched the matches that night. But they would run it about once a month. And then eventually we were running it there toward, before I left, we were running it maybe once every 3 weeks.
Bobby, what's the difference in Phillips and the Omni?
Seat-wise? Or just the difference in the building?
Seat-wise, yeah.
You know, Jerry, I really don't know. I would say it probably hold about the same thing.
That's what I had heard.
The big difference in the facility is there are a lot more private boxes in Phillips Arena, which was the whole reasoning they gave for building the new arena. I mean, there is one side of that building is nothing but private boxes. And they say that's where the money is when you're running an arena like that.
I guess so.
I mean, that was one of the issues with the Georgia Dome is they wanted more private boxes when they built that. They built the dome. They said, we want something with more private boxes. And, they're talking this week up here. The dome is 20 years old, I guess it's 20. I think it opened in 91, 92.
Is that old, really?
Yeah, and they said that, Arthur Blank just put $30 million in it to renovate it, 2 years ago, and took his own money and renovated it. It was all private money. And now they're talking in 2018, 2017, the bonds will be paid off that they issued to build it. They're talking about building a new stadium for the Falcons down the street from the Dome, which makes no sense to me in this economy, but, who knows.
Is it going to be an outdoor?
That's what he wants.
I think they all should be outdoor myself.
I agree. However, I will tell you this. When it's 10 degrees outside or it's raining cats and dogs, I kind of like that dome myself. Because I know I'm just dumb enough I'd be sitting right out there in the cold or in the rain, but still,
since they've reached it. You wouldn't do good in Green Bay as a fan.
No, I doubt very seriously if I would.
I may be off a year, too. I'm thinking the dome opened in 88 because I went to the grand opening.
Y'all can't hear my wife screaming. She says if I played in the middle of I-20, I'd be out there dodging cars.
I know you would.
My then wife worked for a company, which is no longer in existence, called MSA, Management Science America. It was based in Atlanta, and the owner of MSA, or the CEO of MSA, was one of the owners of the Falcons. His name was John Imlay. So they had a grand opening before they opened the dome. They had a big party there for all the owners, and he invited all the people that worked for MSA, and my wife and I went to that. So I'm thinking, and that was before our daughter was born, so it had to have been 88, 89, somewhere in there. My daughter was born in February of 90. So that was a huge building at that time. I'd never seen that. Well, I had been inside the Superdome. It was bigger than the Superdome. It didn't even seem to be.
Bobby, what kind of rent do they get for that dome when they, like, McMahon comes there?
I have no idea. I can't imagine. He had WrestleMania there, and you know they had, you know, it probably takes them 2 days to set up. So you got to pay rent on it while you're setting it up. I'm sure at a reduced rate, but I mean it just ain't no telling what he paid for that. Well, I don't know, you know, and then again too, you don't know what kind of tax concessions he got or breaks in the rent he got too for bringing that thing here, because they don't tell him how much money it brought into the city of Atlanta.
Well, that's true too.
I mean, I just.
Hey, do you ever work in and watch this Superdome show?
Yeah, I worked in Superdome, yeah.
What was the
sure
most
did.
Bad for wrestling? Do you remember?
When I was there, it was like 34,000 or 36,000 people. That's the biggest crowd I've ever been in front of.
And you worked there, was it a sellout?
No. No.
I know, Watson always said the first Superdome show that they ran there, 78, I guess it was, the main event was Ray Candy and Ernie Ladd, and they sold it out.
No, they could have. I wasn't on that one.
I would imagine there was money to be made there.
Well, it depends on what you consider a sellout now. I mean, that thing will hold over, 78,000, 79,000 people.
Something, I would think.
And I just don't know that he drew that. Now, they may have had it on a smaller configuration. But, and there again, too, you'll never get a straight answer as to how much money they actually drew either. I can remember Thanksgiving night, and I don't remember what year it was. It might have been 1977, 76. Must have been 76, or maybe 78. It might have been after I came back. It had to be. I remember Thanksgiving night, we drew $101,000. It's the first time in Atlanta history we had broken the $100,000 barrier. And I mean, you would have thought we had found the cure for cancer. I mean, it was
that was
Friday
of
in the
then,
office
Bobby.
Was it was a pleasant place to be.
That was a lot of money then, man.
Yes, it was. Yes, it was.
A lot of money.
And you know, and like I say, I mean, you know, people gonna believe what they want to believe, but I know, I mean, I did them, Barnett. But I think the tax was 7% back then, 6-7%. I can't remember, but keeping it at 100,000, 6% of that, $6,000, and you divide that, you take 33% of whatever that was, and that's what he paid the talent. And I don't remember how many people he had on the card. I'm sure it was a tag tournament, so there was a lot of people there, and there was some transportation involved and stuff. But the transportation did not come out of the talent pay. It came out of, you know, the other end. But that was a heck of a house.
But you know, guys trying to run now, you rent any kind of building, man, it's outrageous. It's outrageous. I mean,
well, I harp on this, Jerry, but these guys that are running now, they have no clue what they're doing. And, you know, my guess is 99% of them don't have insurance. It takes one accident. You know, people say, it ain't going to happen to me. That's why they call them accidents. Yeah, it takes one person tripping, you know. And whether you win the lawsuit or you lose, you got to defend yourself.
You lose either way,
and the lawyers don't work for free. So it's just
I think most of these people that are doing it just so they can get in a ring somewhere.
Yeah, I agree. One fella in particular, and I won't call no names, but one fella told me. I asked him. I said, "How much money do you make doing this?" He was running some shows, and he said, "I don't do this to make money." And I said, "Pardon me?" He said, I don't do this to make money. I said, why do you do it? He said, I just want to be in the wrestling business. And I thought to myself, you have lost your mind.
We all wanted to be in it too, but Luke Bear said one time that, nobody gets in the wrestling business for fun. It's about the money.
You won't be compensated for it. Huh?
We all love this business, and we work, you know, we work for almost nothing. I mean, that's, you know, if you were honest with ourselves, there's a lot of nights we probably went in the hole.
Yep.
And we've all talked about it, and it's very truthful. We would do it again if we were able. But the thing is you didn't, you know,
Bobby, the thing about it is they don't have any overhead. They don't have to buy any gear anymore.
No.
No boots, no trunks.
No.
No. Come on, Jeff. You know, I mean, back in that was $15, $20 for us. I mean, it wasn't a whole lot of overhead for us.
Well, you know, I went, I don't know, maybe, crap, it might have been 10 years ago, I don't know. I was riding with Ted Allen to Mobile, and his phone rang, and it was some guy that was running a show in Douglas, Georgia, which we used to run periodically, and the guy goes, Ted goes, well, I don't know, here you can ask him, and he hands me the phone, and I didn't know the guy, and the guy told me who he was, and he said he had a show down there he had sold to a car lot. And he told me, he says, I want a referee to help run this show that knows what they're doing. I don't want a kid down here that don't know what they're doing. He said, will you come down here and work for me? And I told him, I said, well, I said, I don't need no experience. I said, you know, what are you talking about paying me? And he quoted me a figure, and I looked at Ted and kind of, is this guy good for the money? And Ted went, yeah, and I agreed to go. So me and Ted went down there to work this show. And it was a car lot thing, you know, it wasn't bad, it was just what it was. But that night Ted had to work for this same guy in Fitzgerald, Georgia. And I went, the same building we used to run in, Jerry, that old high school gym or whatever it was there. And I went up there and I was just sitting up in the bleachers watching, and I watched the first match and guys was jumping off the top rope and hitting the floor and doing this and doing, I mean, they were just doing all kind of crazy stuff. And I walked back in the dressing room, and one of the kids asked me, he said, well, what'd you think? And I said, well, what do you mean, what did I think? And he said, well, how'd you like the match? And I went, well, I didn't know what to say. I said, why'd y'all do all that stuff? And he goes, well, you know, just to, I said, look, man, I said, you're on the first match. I said, do you think what few people's out there came to see y'all? I said, unless your mom and daddy's out there, I said, they didn't pay to see y'all. They come to see whatever the main event is, whoever they are. I said, you know, you got to go out there and set the tone for what's going to be going on. I said, what's the second match going to do, jump off the top of the building? I said, you know, I mean, I don't understand. I mean, well, of course, there is no philosophy, but I don't understand people anymore.
You were talking over their head, Bobby.
I mean, I don't know.
That's the sad part of what's been forgotten and lost, you know.
Going back to what Jay was talking about, boots and tights, remember you had to know somebody in the wrestling business to even get your hands on a catalog from K&H. Literally, I mean, those things were, they were few and far between. You had to know somebody that was willing to let you have it.
What do you reckon one of them things would be worth on eBay?
There's no telling.
I just happen to know somebody that found one.
I think I still got one somewhere.
I found one and stuck it in one of my photo albums. I got it right back there still. I think the boots were $12.
Yep.
Or maybe they were $20. It may have been a newer catalog, but I don't think they ever were over $20 when they were sending out catalogs.
And they only came in white and black.
And, you know, back then you could call them, and they would COD it to you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's what I was going to say. When you called them, if they didn't know who you were, they gave you the third degree, too. Who you were, how did you get their number and all that stuff?
I'm going to tell you what, man. They had a good product.
Yes, they did.
Their trunks were unbelievable.
You couldn't wear them out.
I still have Carl Hildegard trunks that I could wear tonight.
Hmm.
I never bought their boots. I got my boots from Bill Ash.
No, I never wore their boots either. I couldn't work in those boots.
I don't have them anymore. I used to get them and have the soles redone.
Well, you had to. Because you wore those slick bottom boots.
The first pair I ever got, I tried to work in them and you couldn't stand up. It was like being on ice.
But you know, like Briscoe, that's all he wore.
Yeah.
I don't know how those guys wrestle in those boots. I couldn't do it.
But I had Now you wore a lot of the boots that the guy in Texas made, didn't you, Jerry?
Yeah.
So I never got any from him. I think I've got two pair back there left. I've got one pair of that Abdullah brought me back from Japan that he had shark skin put on the toes so that I wouldn't wear them out.
That's what I have on mine.
And then I've got a pair that I got from Ash.
And, I didn't care for the Ash boots.
They were stiff.
Yeah, I didn't
they
like
were them. Very. Yeah, they were. They were not. They weren't. They looked all right, but they weren't real comfortable to me.
Clifford Houston made the best boot.
I like that ass and that sole on them, but you're right, Bobby. Mine, if I took them out, that packed up. If I took them out of the suitcase and took the strings off them and pulled the shank of them back up, they still stand up straight.
I got a pair right back here in the closet, Michael, and they're standing straight up. and the pair that Abdullah got me in Japan, the leather is the people in Japan made a pretty good shoe too.
They made a good boot.
That pair of boots he brought me from Japan, you couldn't make them stand up. You could spray starch on them and they wouldn't stand up. That leather's so soft.
Yeah, they made a good boot.
Did you ever buy any shoestrings from Mr. Allison at the skating ring?
No, I did not.
I kept, you know, we used to get, when the strings that came in the boots would wear out, we would buy, you know, that nylon clothesline.
Right.
And we'd make our own shoestrings. You know, we'd burn the ends off and
right.
Twist it with a piece of paper. I was sitting down there one night and I was trying to put a new pair in there, and Mr. Allison seen me. I was sitting outside the dressing room there, and he said, "Why are you doing that?" And I said, "Well, you know, I just got to find something long enough." He said, "I got just the thing." And he went over there, and he had shoelaces that fit them boot skates. Man, them things was, you stretch them out, and they was a mile long.
Well, I'm gonna tell you,
and he would sell them to us for about $1 a pair, and that's what I started using.
Shoelaces were hard to find.
Yes, they were.
And once I found the place, that was my place where I got them.
Mm-hmm.
I tell you what I always had a hard time finding was knee pants. Jerry, you never wore knee pants, did you?
Yeah, later on I did. I wish I'd have started with them. But nobody wore them when I started.
You could find the ones that were like soccer players and stuff like that, but you couldn't. And they were hard to find the ones that were vintage behind the knee that wouldn't, you know, ride up and bundle up behind your knee.
The best ones I ever wore were Flaircos. You remember those, Bobby?
Yes, sir. I remember the name.
They were the best.
You want me to tell you the best thing I ever found and wore under my pants?
What?
And I bet you ain't even going to remember this till I tell you what I wore. Because I got them from Jerry Oates. They were rubbery, and they came from King of Prussia, Pennsylvania.
You know what, Bobby?
And I don't know where you got them, but it's the best thing I ever had.
I had on a pair one night. I was getting dressed, and Eddie Graham said, "Where did you get those?" And, you know, I don't know how I got on to them. Were they unbelievable?
I seen that thing. I seen you with them on, and I asked you about them, and you got me a couple of them. And matter of fact, I think I still got one back here in the drawer. Them things were absolutely – they weren't padded, Michael, like a knee pad was, but what they were, they gave you some support.
They were unbelievable.
They were wonderful.
I forgot about those. But I remember Eddie Graham said, "Where did you get those?" And I gave him the address. Next time I saw him, he had a pair.
Yeah. Best thing I ever come across.
I have a pair of white ones because I figured the first pair I bought were white because I figured they'd go with whatever I wore. Well, I wore those out, and then the next pair I looked all over, and I finally found a place in Cantona, Florida, right outside of Pensacola. They have a sporting goods store there, and I bought a pair, the only pair they had, and they were purple. They didn't match anything I had. why they have they still had those left. It was like the one the five pair of purple. But those were hard to find with the vents on the back of them like that.
Well, we've just run the gamut of stuff tonight, haven't we?
So we touched on undergear, overgear.
I got. How many of your ring jackets do you have left, Jerry?
About three of them.
You guys always wore those things that were very similar to a college basketball warm-up, which I always loved.
I thought they looked the best.
I mean, loved them. And the one you had that I liked better, than you and Ted both had one. You had one that had the map on the back.
Yes.
And said, I'm from Georgia. I thought that was the neatest thing. I just thought that was a great look.
You know, I don't know what happened to that jacket. That was a gorgeous jacket.
Yes, it was. I've got I got one ring jacket left, and I don't know what happened to it. It won't quite meet in the front anymore, but...
It shrunk, man.
Yeah, it must have, but it's red and black, and Olivia Walker made it for me.
Yeah, she made some great stuff.
And I've held on to it.
I've got two. The only two I ever had. The first one I had, it was a baseball jacket. A silk baseball jacket. I bought that, and I wore that, and then I got a red one, red satin one, with silver piping on it that Olivia Walker made that I bought from Jerry Stubbs. And I still got those back up on my one pair of boots and
Bobby, how many programs do you have left?
Not very many. I sold all of them.
Wouldn't you like to have kept every
program
you had your hands on?
Jerry, I found a box in a garage a couple years ago, 3 years ago now, I guess. Randy, my buddy Randy, and you know Randy, he had 160-something programs. And some guy online was posted he was looking for old programs. The guy paid Randy $400-something for 160 programs.
You kidding me?
And I was going through the garage looking and cleaning out stuff, and I found this box, and it was slap full. I had programs from when Dickey ran Columbus in the 70s. I had Atlanta programs. I had programs from Mobile. I had programs from just everywhere. And I was bad. I was bad back then about, you know, Dickey was always good about throwing 10, 12 programs in the dressing room, you know, and a lot of people would. Mr. Ward would do that. And at the end of the night, if people hadn't picked them up, I'd grab them, throw them in my bag. And I guess that's what these were. Just I mean, there was all sorts of stuff back there. And I told Randy, I said, look, I got these things. And I went through them, and I pulled out if there was some in there that had a picture in there I wanted to keep or whatever. But it wound up being 400 and almost 500 programs. And he contacted this same guy, and I don't know who he is. Have no clue. Randy was my agent on this deal. The guy gave me $950 for them programs.
Oh, come on, man.
If I'm lying, I'm flying. It played for my trip to Vegas 2 years ago.
Just think how many went through your hands.
Jeez. Only thing my wife said was, I get half of whatever you get. And I said, okay.
Man,
but that was, I mean, just,
I've got quite a few. Nothing like that.
Well, buddy, I'm telling you, there's people out there that will pay buku bucks for them.
How about the posters?
Oh, geez.
That makes me sick.
I had half a dozen of the old pink, yellow, and green ones that were, ones that Ron Fuller put out when he first started running in Mobile in 78. I don't even remember how I came across them, but they were made in Atlanta. There was a poster company in Atlanta that made them.
Southeastern Poster Company.
Yeah, it's exactly
remember the rainbow posters?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, that's what these were. They were rainbow colored. And I had those up until probably 6-7 years ago, and I gave them to Ted Allen. They were just sitting around here, and I was never going to do anything with them, so I gave them to him. But you're talking about a collector. And when we used to stop at Ted's house on the way to Chattanooga, the house show in Chattanooga, we Carterville, and have lunch at Ted's house after doing, you know, the TV show in the morning. And he was the first person I ever knew that had a VCR. He had tapes then, you know, of all over, not only Georgia, but stuff from Tennessee, you know, stuff from all these little independents that ran up around Carterville that people like Buddy Atlas used to run. He had tapes of all that stuff. He had, I don't know how many crates full of magazines, but Ted was a collector from way back. I'm sure probably he probably had stuff he got when he was a kid still. He probably still had when he passed away.
Well, I'll tell you how good a collector he was. You remember Mary Bunch, Jerry, in Columbus?
Oh, please.
When Miss Bunch died, they called my ex-in-laws, and they turned around and called me and said, she's got a bunch of wrestling stuff. Would you like to have it? Magazines, programs, blah, blah, blah. Yeah, I'll come get it. They said, we just want to give it to somebody that'll appreciate it. Well, I got it, and I went through it. And, you know, there was some stuff that was okay, but a lot of that stuff I didn't care nothing about. So I called Ted, and I went, Ted, I got all this stuff down here. You want to come get it? Because there again, I knew he would appreciate it. So he comes down here, and he picks it up. When we get to Mobile that year, all that stuff I give him, he's got laid out on his bed in his room, and he's got a price on each one. And he had went through and marked. If there was a guy at the reunion whose picture was in the magazine, he had marked it so that the guy's going to go, oh, there's a picture of me, and it's $3. And he sold all that stuff. Yeah, I told him, I said, where's my cut?
He was an entrepreneur.
Yes, he was.
And the same year I gave him some posters, Bobby. I should have maybe traded him.
But listen, he probably sold them. God love him.
Yeah, he was there.
Yeah, we took all of it for granted, guys.
Yes, we did.
Every bit of it.
Before we get away here tonight, Mike, and you probably better than me because you can remember who it was. I don't know if Jerry saw it or not, but we were reviewed by one of the internet sites, and it was very favorable.
It was. Called WrestlingScout.com is the blog site. Did Rich send you a copy of that, Jerry?
No. I don't think.
I'll send you a copy of where he reviewed us. I'm trying to figure out which one of us he said that we were homespun and folksy. It had to have been you two. Bobby must have been homespun and Bobby and Jerry folksy.
I guess. I'm the only way I know how to be, so I guess that's me.
We are what we are, right?
But he gave us a 5-star rating on that little review he did. I was very, very pleased and thankful.
Wonderful.
That was good.
That's wonderful.
The headline of his blog said, let me find, because I was going to bring that up. It said, Wrestling Scout report review of Peach State Pandemonium, the best podcast on the web.
So, really?
Yeah, so I'm sure Rich is going to give us all a raise, and we'll all get a turkey at Christmas time.
Yeah, maybe my ham at Thanksgiving. You can't ever tell.
If we get that high rating. Well, I appreciate that. I really do.
I think
I have fun doing this. I really do.
I know. It's hard to come up with stuff interesting enough to talk about for two hours each week, but. And sometimes I'm sure we probably bore all but our regular listeners to death. But we get a lot of good comments from different people. People that I think complete strangers will send me stuff on Facebook and other places complimenting our show. So it's a labor of love for me.
Well, I love it. I love talking about it.
I'll be perfectly honest. When Rich first approached me about doing this, I made every reason in the world I could not to do it. Because I really didn't know that I would enjoy it, didn't know what to talk about. This is a highlight of my week, fellas.
I'm telling
you. I look forward to this. I really do. One other thing I want to mention before we wind things down here in a few minutes is next Wednesday will be February the 1st, and our buddy Mr. Charlie Smith will be celebrating his 82nd birthday. And I hope if the good Lord allows me to live that long, I'm as spry and as aggravating as he is.
Well, you're headed in that right direction.
Well, I'm working on it. I'm working on it.
Yes, I hope we all live.
My baby girl will be 34 this Saturday, and I'm barely walking thinking about that. So.
Well, I hope we all make it at least that long.
Yeah, me too.
Your oldest son will be 52 tomorrow.
Yeah. Tomorrow's your birthday. I told Debbie. I said, "Crap." My son Jody will be 36 this year. I said, "Crap, I done inherited a 50-something year old." I said, "Dang."
Well, happy birthday, Mike.
Thank you.
I hope you have many more, my boy.
I'm planning on it.
Well, I've adopted the Charlie Smith philosophy. I want to live to be 120 and get shot by a jealous husband. So, you know.
And he probably will.
Well, you got that right.
I want to be 120 and get trampled by elephants.
There's nothing wrong with that. Maybe I can go out of a cannon.
There you go.
I don't know. I've got ways to go before I can set the cannon.
How old are you going to be tomorrow, Michael? 52?
52.
52, okay.
Puppies.
I'm almost as old as Jerry.
Almost.
No, and nowhere near as good as Jerry.
Well, I tell you, when you sit and think about, you know, how old you are, it's like, where did it go, you know?
Oh,
my gosh.
I told somebody the other day, I'll be 57 this year, and I told somebody, I said, we were talking the other day, and I said, you know, time's is so irrelevant to me. It's hard for me to keep dates and stuff from years ago, but I said, I can remember at 13 and 14 looking forward to my driver's license at 16. And I thought, man, I just can't wait. And it seemed like time was never going to get there for me to get my driver's license. And now I look back and I've been driving 41 years and I think about all them miles that's under the belt now. And I think, my Lord, where did it go? Where did it go?
That's what I'm telling you, man.
Jeez.
Scary.
I don't feel old until I think about my daughter's age. My daughter and... 11
days will be 22. That's when I start to feel
a little
bit. I mean,
it just seems like, you know, yesterday she was born.
It's unbelievable. I know you look back and you just, where did it go? I mean, it's just.
Well,
there's the final bell.
That's it. Saved by the bell.
Yeah.
I promise I'll either have us a guest or something real to talk about next week.
Well, I thought we did all right tonight.
I was fixing to say we've covered a good bit tonight. Oh.
Hopefully our listeners haven't been too terribly bored and we didn't repeat ourselves too much. I certainly appreciate our listeners. Yeah, anybody that listens to us, give the other shows on the Georgia Radio Network a go. From Ringside Rap, Georgia Now, OBW Review. The Midnight Black Mass, Midnight, or whatever it's called. And I'm sorry, I'm not up on those shows because I don't really have time to listen to all of them. But I appreciate our listeners, and I'm sure the other guys will appreciate you guys tuning in. I'm telling you, if you love the wrestling business, whether it's the past like we talk about or the current stuff, our shows run the gamut. So, Give them all a listen. I'm sure you'll find something that fits in your niche. You love it as much as we love doing this. But that's it for us, guys. I'm working on something for 2 weeks from now. I'll hopefully next week I'll be able to announce it. But,
well, Mike, you have a happy birthday here.
Well, thank you. And you guys have a good weekend. And
If I don't talk to you between now and then, we'll get together next week and we'll do this all over again.
Sounds good.
Sounds good. Happy birthday, Jerry. Have a good week, my boy.
You too, Bobby.
See
you, you guys.
Take care, guys.
Bye.
We thank you for listening to the Tribecast, a production brought to you by GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com and the GWH Radio Network. Stay tuned to GWH for nostalgia, upcoming events, and more. As always, GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com thanks you for your continued support.